himself to put them under the copper, where they were burned on Monday morning. Greatly to Mrs. Cutler's surprise, the lamb had been brought in just as she had been lying on the rock, without a corset. A modest woman, for whom the word corset was never uttered by a lady in the presence of a gent, she had made no comment to the doctor, who had simply assumed that the girl had very sensibly gone to a school picnic, minus that tomfool garment responsible, in his opinion, for 1,000 female complaints. Thus, the valuable clue of the missing corset was never followed up, nor communicated to the police, nor to the inmates of Appleyard College, where Irma Leopold, well known for her fastidious taste in matters of dress, had been seen by several of her classmates on the morning of Saturday, the 14th of February, wearing a pair of long, lightly boned French satin stays. The body was unblemished and virginal. After careful examination, Dr. Cooling pronounced the girl to be suffering from nothing more serious than shock and exposure. No broken bones, and only a few minor cuts and bruises on the face and hands. On the hands, especially, the nails were badly torn and broken. There was a possibility of concussion compatible with bruising in certain areas of the head. Nothing much, but he would like another professional opinion.
"Well, thank God for that," said Colonel Fitzhubert, on pins and needles in the tiny front passage. "As far as my wife and I are concerned, Miss Leopold can stay here until she's well enough to be moved. Mrs. Cutler is a first-rate nurse."
At sunset, when Dr. Mackenzie dropped in to take a look at Michael on his way home, he went down to the lodge for a consultation with Dr. Cooling, who was just taking his leave.
"I agree with you, Cooling," said the old man. "It's a miracle. By all ordinary textbook standards, the patient should have been dead long ago."
"I'd give my head to know what happened up there on the rock," Cooling said.
"And where the dickens are the other two girls, and the governess?"
It was arranged that Dr. Mackenzie should take over the patient along with Michael Fitzhubert, whose nurse would be available for any extra services that might be necessary.
"They won't be necessary," Dr. Mackenzie smiled. "I know your Mrs. Cutler, Colonel. She'll do this job on her head and enjoy it. Rest, that's the main thing. And if possible, when she regains consciousness, peace of mind."
Dr. Cooling had driven off at dusk, well satisfied.
"All's well that ends well, Doctor, and thanks for your help. Sort of case that might easily have turned out a bit tricky. We'll soon be reading all about it in the papers, no doubt."
Dr. Mackenzie, however, was not so confident. He went back into the bedroom and stood there, looking thoughtfully at the pale, heart-shaped face on the pillow. There was no telling, especially with the young and tender, how the intricate mechanism of the brain would react to severe emotional shock. Instinct told him she must have suffered damnably, if not in body, in mind, no matter what had or had not occurred at the Hanging Rock. This wasn't, he was beginning to suspect, an ordinary case. Just how extraordinary, he didn't yet know. For Mike, the timeless days melted imperceptibly into timeless nights. Sleeping or waking, it made no difference in the dim grey regions where he was forever seeking some unknown, nameless thing. Invariably, it vanished, just as he drew near. Sometimes he would wake and touch it as it brushed past, only to find himself clutching at the blanket on his bed. A burning pain in his foot came and went, gradually lessening as his head grew clearer. Sometimes he was conscious of the smell of disinfectant, sometimes of a drift of flowery scent from the garden. When he opened his eyes, there was always somebody in the room, usually a strange young woman who seemed to be dressed in white paper that crackled when she moved. It might have been the third or fourth day when he fell at last into a deep, dreamless sleep. When he woke up, the room was in darkness, except for a pale incandescent light given off by a white swan sitting on the brass rail end of his bed. Michael and the swan looked at each other without surprise, until the beautiful creature slowly raised its wings and floated away through the open window. He slept again, awoke to sunshine and the scent of pansies. An elderly man with a clipped beard was standing beside the bed.
"You're a doctor,"
said Mike, in a voice for the first time recognizably his own.
"What's wrong with me?" "You've had a pretty bad fall and hurt your ankle and knocked yourself about a bit. Looking better today, though. How long have I been ill?" "Let's see, must be 5 or 6 days now since they brought you back from the Hanging Rock." "Hanging Rock? What was I doing at Hanging Rock?"
"We'll talk about it later," said Dr. Mackenzie.
"Nothing to worry about, my boy.
Worry never did a sick man any good. Now, let's have a look at your ankle." While the ankle was being bandaged, Mike said,
"The Arab. Did I fall off?"
And fell asleep again. When the nurse brought his breakfast the next morning, the patient was sitting up and asking loudly and clearly for Albert.
"My, we are getting better quickly. Now drink up your tea while it's nice and hot."
"I want to see Albert Crundle."
"Oh, you mean the coachman? He comes up here every morning to ask after you. Such devotion."
"What time does he usually come?"
"Soon after breakfast, but you're not allowed visitors yet. You know, Mr. Fitzhubert, Dr. Mackenzie's orders."
"I don't care what his orders are. I insist on seeing Albert, and if you won't deliver my message, I'll jolly well get out of bed and go down to the stables myself."
"Now, now," said the nurse with a professional smile that turned her into an advertisement for toothpaste. "Don't go getting yourself all worked up, or I'll get the blame."
Something about the strangely glittering eyes of the devastatingly handsome youth made her add,
"Eat up your breakfast, and I'll fetch your uncle."
Colonel Fitzhubert, summoned to the bedside, came tiptoeing in on eggshells with a face suitably lugubrious for a sick room, and was overjoyed at seeing the patient actually sitting up and with quite a high colour.
"Splendid! Looking almost yourself this morning, isn't he, nurse? Now then, what's all this I hear about wanting visitors?"
"Not visitors, only Albert. I want Albert..."
His head fell back against the pillows.
"Overtired, that's what we are," said the nurse. "If my patient gets talking to that coachman, his temperature will go up for certain, and I'll be getting a what for from Dr. Mackenzie."
"The girl's not only a plain Jane, but an ass," the colonel decided, aware of currents beyond his understanding. "Don't worry, Mike.
I'll tell Crundle to come up and see you for 10 minutes. If there's any trouble, nurse, I'll take the blame.
At last, Albert was here beside him, smelling of Capstan cigarettes and fresh hay, and settling himself into the bedside chair as if it were a restive colt ready to turn and bolt under his weight. He had never before been an official visitor to a sick room and was at a loss how to begin a conversation with a disembodied face cut off at the chin by the rigidly folded sheet.
That bloody nurse of yours went for her life as soon as she saw me coming.
It was as good a kick-off as any. Mike even gave a faint grin. The tide of friendship flowed between them.
Good for you.
Mind if I smoke?
Go ahead. They won't let you stay long.
The old comfortable silence settled down between them like a cat on a communal hearth, and they were at one.
Look, Mike said. There's a lot I have to know. Until last night, my head was in such a muddle, I couldn't think properly. My aunt came in here and started talking to the nurse. I think they thought I was asleep. Suddenly, it all began to sort itself out. It seems that I went back to the Hanging Rock on my own without telling anyone but you. Is that right?
That's right. To look for the Sheilas.
Take it easy, Mike. You don't look too good on it yet.
I've found one of them. Is that right?
That's right, Albert said again. You found her, and she's up here at the lodge, alive and kicking.
Which one? Michael asked in a voice so low Albert could hardly hear. The lovely face, lovely even on the stretcher as they had carried her down the rock, was always in his mind now. Irma Leopold, the little dark one with the curls. The room was so quiet that Albert could hear Mike's heavy breathing as he lay with his face turned to the wall.
So you've nothing to worry about, Albert said. Only to hurry up and get well.
Stone the crows?
He's passed out. Where's that bloody nurse got to?
The 10 minutes had expired, and she was there at the bedside, doing something with a bottle and spoon. Albert slipped past her, through the French windows, and made his way to the stables with a heavy heart.
9. Girl's body on rock. Missing heiress found. Once again, the college mystery was front-page news, embellished with the wildest flights of imagination, public and private. The rescued girl was still unconscious at Lakeview, and the Honourable Michael Fitzhubert was not well enough to be questioned, which added fuel to the flame of gossip and rumoured horrors to be later disclosed. The police search of likely and unlikely places in the locality had been resumed with extra men from Melbourne. The dog and the tracker brought back on the remote possibility of unearthing a clue to the fate of the other three victims. Drains, hollow logs, culverts, water holes, an abandoned pigsty where someone had seen a light moving last Sunday. At the bottom of an old mine shaft in the Black Forest, a terrified schoolboy swore he had seen a body. And so he had. The carcass of a decomposing heifer. And so it went on. Constable Bumfer, still conscientiously sweating over notebooks filled with unanswerable questions, would almost have welcomed a brand new murder. At Appleyard College, the news of Irma's rescue was briefly and formally announced by the headmistress, directly after prayers on the following Monday morning. A carefully considered procedure that allowed a full hour for its assimilation before the first classes of the day. After a moment of stunned silence, it was received with outbursts of hysterical joy, tears, fond embraces between people barely on speaking terms. On the staircase, where loitering was strictly forbidden, Mademoiselle had come upon Blanche and Rosamond locked in a tearful embrace.
"Allons, mes enfants, this is no moment for tears,"
and felt her own, long unshed, rising to her eyes. In the kitchen, cook and Minnie rejoiced over a glass of stout, while on the other side of the baize door, Dora Lumley clutched the cheap lace at her throat, as if she too had been rescued upon the rock. Tom and Mr. Whitehead, at first jubilant in the potting shed, had soon passed on to murder in general, winding up with Jack the Ripper and the gardener gloomily supposing he must be getting back to his lawns. By midday, the inevitable reaction from the rapturous relief of the morning was general. Afternoon classes assembled to an undercurrent of whisperings and mutterings. In the governess's sitting room, the subject of Irma's discovery was barely touched on. As if by common consent, the thin veils of make-believe obscuring the ugly realities were left intact, and only the headmistress, behind the closed doors of her study, permitted herself a cold-blooded scrutiny of this new turn of affairs. With the finding of only one of the four missing persons, the situation as it affected the college had actually deteriorated. Strong-minded persons in authority can ordinarily grapple with practical problems of facts. Facts, no matter how outrageous, can be dealt with by other facts. The problems of mood and atmosphere, known to the press as situations, are infinitely more sinister. A situation cannot be pigeonholed for reference and the appropriate answer pulled out of a filing cabinet. An atmosphere can be generated overnight, out of nothing or everything. Anywhere that human beings are congregated in unnatural conditions. At the Court of Versailles, at Pentridge Jail, at a select college for young ladies where the miasma of hidden fears deepened and darkened with every hour. Waking next morning from an uneasy sleep, the headmistress could feel its pressure on a head already heavy under a hedgehog assortment of steel curling pins. In the dragging hours between midnight and dawn, she had resolved, not without certain misgivings, on a change of policy. A mild relaxation of discipline and variation of the daily seam. To this end, the boarder's sitting room was hastily repapered in a ghastly shade of strawberry pink, and a grand piano was installed in the long drawing room. The Reverend Lawrence and his wife were invited to drive out one evening from the vicarage at Woodend with lantern slides of the Holy Land to be shown in the drawing room, where Mr. Whitehead's choicest hydrangeas were banked up in the fireplaces and coffee, sandwiches and fruit salad were served by the maids in long-tailed caps and frilled aprons. The whole thing presented the perfect picture of a fashionable boarding school at the height of material prosperity and educational well-being. Yet little Mrs. Lawrence drove away with a migraine, unaccountably depressed. In vain were the senior girls sent into Bendigo by train with the governess to witness a matinee of the Mikado. They returned, if anything, in lower spirits. People in the audience had stared and whispered as they took their seats in the front row. They felt themselves a part of the spectacle, the cast of the college mystery, and were thankful to climb into the waiting wagonettes. Conscious of a tactical blunder, the headmistress decided on other and harsher means. A tighter rein on the always too talkative staff, an enforcement of the rule forbidding confidential chattering of groups unattended by a governess. Henceforth, the daily crocodile of girls, in their summer uniforms and ugly straw hats, wound its way two and two along the Bendigo High Road in the prescribed and grudging silence of a female chain gang. Easter was approaching, and with it the end of term. Already the summer flowers were fading, and one morning splashes of gold appeared amongst the willows fringing the creek behind the house. The garden held no autumn delights for the headmistress, to whom well-kept beds and lawns were no more than a symbol of prestige. Neatness was all, and a continuous array of showy blooms to be admired beyond the stone walls by passers-by on the high road. The leaves fluttering down from the little tree outside her study window were an unnecessary reminder of the passing of time. It was now nearly a month since the day of the picnic. Mrs. Appleyard had lately spent a few days in Melbourne, largely at police headquarters in Russell Street. Here, the first thing to catch an eye continually on the alert was a notice pinned on an official board. Missing. Presumed dead. Above, a detailed description and three extremely bad photographs of Miranda, Marion, and Greta McCraw. The word dead leapt obscenely from the printed page. Yes, it was possible, but highly unlikely, said the senior detective with whom she was closeted for 2 hours in a stuffy room, that the girls had been abducted, lured away, robbed, or worse.
And what?
Asked the headmistress, tight-lipped and clammy with fear and the insufferable heat of the room.
Could be worse, may I ask, than that?
It appeared that they might yet be found in a Sydney brothel. Such things happened now and then in Sydney, when girls of respectable background disappeared without a trace. Not often in Melbourne. Mrs. Appleyard could only shudder.
They were exceptionally intelligent and well-behaved girls who would never have allowed any familiarity from strangers.
As far as that goes, said the detective blandly, most young girls would object to being raped by a drunken seaman, if that's what you have in mind.
I did not have it in mind. My knowledge of such things is necessarily limited.
The detective drummed squat tobacco-stained fingers on the top of his desk. These perfect ladies were the devil. Dirty-minded as they come, he wouldn't mind betting. Aloud, he said mildly,
exactly. Most unlikely under the circumstances. However, we policemen have to consider every possible avenue in a case of this kind where not a single clue has come to light since the day it was reported. February 14th, if I remember without looking it up.
That is so. St. Valentine's Day.
For a moment he wondered if the old girl was going off her head. Her face was an unpleasant mottled red. He didn't want her fainting on him and rose, declaring the abortive interview at an end. For Mrs. Appleyard, staggering out into the glaring heat of the street, the interview was over, but the nightmare remained and would not be exorcised by a sleeping pill nor a glass or two of brandy at her city hotel. Back at the college, a series of setbacks and disturbing happenings had been accumulating.
During her absence, a father had called with a seemingly reasonable excuse for taking his daughter away with him then and there. Without the support of Greta McCraw, who in times of crisis could be unexpectedly shrewd, even practical, Mademoiselle had felt obliged to comply, and Miss Lumley was requested to arrange for the packing and dispatch of Muriel's boxes to Melbourne. Worse still, the French governess had handed in her resignation.
On account of my approaching marriage to Monsieur Louis Montpellier shortly after Easter, as soon as Mrs. Appleyard had taken off her hat in the hall.
The headmistress knew a lady when she saw one, and Mademoiselle de Pontiers was definitely a social asset on the staff, not to be easily replaced. Miss McCraw's position had already been filled by a breezy young graduate with prominent teeth and the unhappy name of Buck, to whom the boarders had taken an instant dislike. Greta McCraw, for all her impersonal barking, had never been known to bite an individual wrongdoer. There was a pile of correspondence on Mrs. Appleyard's desk this evening, which had to be read through. Weary as she was, before she could allow herself to go to bed. Thank heaven, nothing with the Queensland postmark. First to be opened was a request from a South Australian mother that her daughter, for urgent family reasons, be sent home immediately on the Adelaide Express. The girl's people were well off, highly respected citizens. What irresponsible talk had they been listening to, smug in their suburban mansion? Family reasons, pah! She took the brandy bottle from the cupboard and had opened two more letters before noticing Mr. Leopold's telegram at the bottom of the pile. Sent a few days ago from some godforsaken address in Bengal, the peremptory wording was utterly unlike the usual extravagant Leopold technique. Under no circumstances is my daughter to return to Appleyard College. Letter follows. To lose in such a manner her richest and most admired pupil made her feel physically faint, almost sick. The implications of this new catastrophe were dangerous and unending. Only a few weeks ago, the headmistress had been telling the bishop's wife,
"Irma Leopold is such a charming girl. Worth half a million when she turns 21, so I understand. Her mother was a Rothschild, you know."
Two enormous bills from butcher and grocer completed the day's tally of woe. Late as it was, she felt impelled to take out the college ledger. Several of the boarders' fees were outstanding, although common sense told her that prompt payment in advance of next term's fees could hardly be expected, under the circumstances, from Miranda's parents or the legal guardian of Marion Quaid. She had been relying on the Leopold check with its numerous extras, dancing, drawing, monthly matinees in Melbourne, all of which showed a handsome profit to the college. On the neatly ruled page, another name stood out. Sarah Wayborn. Sarah's elusive guardian had failed to show himself at her study door for several months, his usual fee-paying procedure, with the amount taken from his pocketbook in cash. At the present moment, a whole term of Sarah's extras was still unpaid for. For Mr. Cosgrove, always expensively dressed, who left behind him in the study the tang of eau de cologne and Morocco leather, there was no excuse for delay. Nowadays, the very sight of the child Sarah slumped over a book in the garden was enough to send a flush of irritation crawling up the head's neck under the boned net collar. The small pointed face was somehow the symbol of the nameless malady from which every inmate of the college was suffering in various degrees. If it had been a weak, rounded, childish face, it might have aroused an answering pity instead of a sense of resentment that one so puny and pale possessed a core of secret strength, a will as steely as her own. Sometimes catching sight of Sarah's bent head in the schoolroom, where the headmistress occasionally descended from Olympus to deliver a scripture lesson, the sour taste of an unmentionable passion had momentarily choked her utterance. Yet the wretched child had remained outwardly docile, polite, and diligent. Only the secret pain in the absurdly large eyes. It was long past midnight. She rose, put the ledger back in its drawer, and climbed heavily upstairs. The following morning, as Sarah Wayborn was getting ready her drawing materials for Mrs. Valange's art class, she was summoned to the headmistress's desk.
"I have sent for you, Sarah, because of a serious matter I have to explain to you. Stand up straight and listen very carefully to what I have to say."
"Yes, Mrs. Appleyard."
"I don't know if you are aware that your guardian has failed to pay for your education here for several months. I have written to him at the usual bank address, but my letters have been returned from the dead letter office in every case."
"Oh," said the child without a change of expression.
"When did you last have a letter from Mr. Cosgrove? Think most carefully."
"I remember quite well, at Christmas, when he asked if I could stay at school over the holidays."
"I remember. It was most inconvenient."
"Was it? I wonder why he hasn't written for such a long time. I want some books and some more crayons."
"Crayons? That reminds me. Since you can give me no help in this unfortunate matter, I shall have to tell Mrs. Valange to discontinue your drawing lessons as from this morning. Please note that any drawing materials in your locker are the property of the college and must be returned to Miss Lumley." "Is that a hole in your stocking?"
"You would be better employed learning to darn than playing about with books and coloured pencils." Sarah had just reached the door when she was called back.
"I omitted to mention that if I have not heard from your guardian by Easter, I shall be obliged to make other arrangements for your education."
For the first time, a change of expression flickered behind the great eyes.
"What arrangements?" "That will have to be decided. There are institutions."
"Oh, no, no, not that. Not again."
"One must learn to face up to facts, Sarah. After all, you are 13 years old. You may go."
While the above conversation was taking place in the study, Mrs. Valange, the visiting art mistress from Melbourne, was being hoisted into the dogcart outside the Woodend station by the nimble Tom, to whom the little lady clung like a drowning sailor, weighed down as usual by a sketching pad, umbrella, and bulging valise. The contents of the valise were invariably the same.
For the senior pupils, a plaster cast of Cicero's head, wrapped in a flannelette nightgown, in case his beak of a nose got chipped in the rattling of the Melbourne train. A plaster foot for the juniors, a roll of Michelet paper, and for herself, a pair of easy slippers with woolen pom-poms and a flask of cognac. A taste for French brandy, had it ever come up for discussion, was about the only subject on which Mrs. Vallange and Mrs. Appleyard were of the same mind. "Well now, Tom," began the voluble and always agreeable art mistress as they turned into the highway under the shade of the eucalypts. "How's your sweetheart?"
"To tell you the truth, ma'am, me and Minnie are both giving the madam notice as Easter. We don't seem to fancy it here any more, if you know what I mean."
"I do know, Tom, and I'm sorry to hear it. You can't think what horrible things people are saying about all this in the city. Though I tell everyone it's best forgotten."
"You're right there, ma'am," Tom agreed. "All the same, Minnie and me will remember Miss Miranda and the other poor creatures till our dying day."
As the dogcart turned in at the college gates, his passenger caught sight of her favourite pupil, Sarah Wayborn, on the front lawn, and briskly waved her umbrella.
"Good morning, Sarah."
"No, thank you, Tom. I prefer to carry the valise myself. Come here, child. I brought you a lovely new box of pastels from Melbourne. Rather expensive, I'm afraid, but it can go down on your account. You're looking rather doleful this morning."
Mrs. Vallange's reception of Sarah's depressing news was characteristic.
"Not go on with your art classes? Nonsense. I am not in the least worried about your fees, considering you are the only one with an ounce of talent. I shall go straight to Mrs. Appleyard and tell her so. We have 10 minutes before class begins."
The interview, which now took place behind the closed door of the study, is unnecessary to record in detail. For the first and last time, the two ladies stood face to face with the gloves off. After a few perfunctory civilities on both sides, the fight was on. Warm-hearted little Mrs. Vallange, lashing out with colourful accusations, emphasised by a dangerously waving umbrella. Mrs. Appleyard, shaken out of her usual public calm, growing even more immense and purple. At last, the door of the study was actually heard to slam, and the art mistress, a moral victor, though beaten on a point of professional procedure, stood with heaving bosom in the hall. Tom was summoned, and Mrs. Vallange, clutching the umbrella and the valise, with Cicero still wrapped in the nightdress, was hoisted into the dogcart and driven away to the station for the last time. After a brief unwanted silence in which his passenger scribbled on scraps of paper with a piece of coloured chalk, Tom was handed half a crown and an envelope addressed to Sarah Wayborn, with instructions to deliver it as soon as possible without Mrs. Appleyard's knowledge. Tom had been only too happy to oblige. He had a soft spot for little Mrs. Vallange, as he had for Sarah, and had every intention of handing her the letter next morning when the boarders congregated for half an hour after breakfast in the garden. However, he was unexpectedly sent off on an errand for the head, and the letter went out of his mind. Weeks later, he came across it, crumpled at the back of the drawer, and Minnie read it out to him by the light of her candle. It kept both of them awake half the night. Although, as Minnie very sensibly pointed out, what was the use of worrying their soul cases out? It was hardly Tom's fault, under the circumstances, that the letter had never been delivered. "Dear child," she had written,
Mrs. A has told me everything. What a ridiculous fuss about nothing. This is to tell you I want you to come and stay with me for as long as you like at my home in East Melbourne, address enclosed, if your guardian doesn't come for you by Good Friday. Just let me know, and I will arrange to meet the train. Don't worry about the art lessons, and keep on drawing whenever you get a spare minute, like Leonardo da Vinci. Fond love, your friend, Henrietta Vallange. Mrs. Vallange's dramatic exit from the college intensified the strains and tensions of the last few days. Despite frustrating rules of silence and the ban on talking in twos and threes without a governess in attendance, it had been conveyed, before nightfall, by the passing of scraps of paper and other news-carrying devices, that a scene had occurred in the study and that the child, Sarah, was somehow to blame. Sarah, as usual, had nothing to communicate. "Creeping about like an oyster," as Edith, never strong on natural history, pointed out. "If we don't get a handsome young drawing master," said Blanche, "I'm going to give up art. I'm sick of coloured chalk in my nails." Dora Lumley came bustling up. "Girls, didn't you hear the dressing bells? Go upstairs at once and take an order mark each for talking in the passage." A few minutes later, still on the prowl, Miss Lumley came upon Sarah Wayborn, curled up behind the little door of the circular staircase leading to the tower. The governess thought she had been crying, but it was too dark to see her face properly. When they came out onto the landing under the light from the hanging lamp, the child looked like a stray, half-starved kitten. "What's the matter, Sarah? Are you feeling ill?"
"I'm all right. Please go away.
People don't sit down on cold stone in the dark just before tea time unless they're weak in the head," Miss Lumley said.
"I don't want any tea. I don't want anything." The governess sniffed.
"Well, lucky you. I only wish I could say the same," she thought. "This wretched, snivelling child, this horrible house," and decided to write to her brother this very night, asking him to look out for a position. "Not a boarding school, I tell you. I can't stand much more of it, Reg." It was as much as she could do not to scream as the tea bell clanged through the empty rooms below. The mice, frisking in the long, dark drawing room, heard it too, and scampered off under the shrouded sofas and chairs.
"You heard the bell, Sarah? You can't go down like that with cobwebs all over you. If you aren't hungry, you'd better go to bed."
It was the same room that Sarah had formerly shared with Miranda, the most coveted room in the house, with long windows overlooking the garden and rose-patterned curtains. Nothing had been changed since the day of the picnic by Mrs. Appleyard's express instructions. Miranda's soft, pretty dresses still hung in orderly rows in the cedar cupboard, from which the child invariably averted her eyes. Miranda's tennis racket still leaned against the wall, exactly as it did when its owner, flushed and radiant, came running upstairs after a game with Marion on a summer evening. The treasured photograph of Miranda in an oval silver frame on the mantelpiece, the bureau drawer still stuffed with Miranda's valentines, the dressing table where she had always put a flower in Miranda's little crystal vase. Often, pretending to sleep, she'd lain awake watching Miranda brushing out her shining hair by the light of the candle.
"Sarah, are you still awake, you naughty puss?"
smiling into the dark pool of the mirror. And sometimes Miranda would sing,
in a special, tuneless voice that only Sarah knew. Strange little songs about her family, a favorite horse, her brother's cockatoo. Someday, Sarah, you shall come home with me to the station and see my sweet, funny family for yourself. Would you like that, Pussy? Oh, Miranda. Miranda. Darling Miranda, where are you? At last, night came upon the silent, wakeful house. In the south wing, Tom and Minnie, locked in each other's arms, murmuring endlessly of love. Mrs. Appleyard tossed in her curling pins. Dora Lumley sucked peppermints and wrote interminable letters to her brother in her fevered head. The New Zealand sisters had crept into the same bed for company and were lying side by side, taut and fearful of an impending earthquake. A light was still burning in Mademoiselle's room, where a stiff dose of Racine by the light of a solitary candle had so far failed as a soporific. The child Sarah was also wide awake, staring into the dreadful dark. Presently, the possums came prancing out onto the dim moonlight slates of the roof. With squeals and grunts, they wove obscenely about the squat base of the tower, dark against the paling sky. 10. The reader, taking a bird's-eye view of events since the picnic, will have noticed how various individuals on its outer circumference have somehow become involved in the spreading pattern. Mrs. Vallange, Reg Lumley, Monsieur Louis Montpellier, Minnie and Tom, all of whose lives have already been disrupted, sometimes violently. So too have the lives of innumerable lesser fry, spiders, mice, beetles, whose scuttlings, burrowings, and terrified retreats are comparable, if on a smaller scale. At Appleyard College, out of a clear sky, from the moment the first rays of light had fired the dahlias on the morning of St. Valentine's Day, and the boarders, waking early, had begun the innocent interchange of cards and favours, the pattern had begun to form. Until now, on the evening of Friday the 13th of March, it was still spreading, still fanning out in depth and intensity, still incomplete. On the lower levels of Mount Macedon, it continued to spread, though in gayer colours to the upper slopes, where the inhabitants of Lakeview, unaware of their allotted places in the general scheme of joy and sorrow, light and shade, went about their personal affairs as usual, unconsciously weaving and interweaving the individual threads of their private lives into the complex tapestry of the whole. Both the invalids were now progressing favorably. Mike was breakfasting on bacon and eggs, and Irma had been pronounced by Dr. Mackenzie well enough for some gentle questioning by Constable Bumfer. Already advised that the girl so far had remembered nothing of her experiences on the rock, nor, in Dr. Mackenzie's opinion, all that of the two eminent specialists from Sydney and Melbourne, would she ever remember. A portion of the delicate mechanism of the brain appeared to be irrevocably damaged.
"Like a clock, you know," the doctor explained. "A clock that stops under a certain set of unusual conditions and refuses ever to go again beyond a particular point. I had one at home. Never got beyond 3 o'clock on an afternoon."
Bumfer, however, was prepared to call on Irma at the lodge and, in his own words, give it a go. The interview had begun at 10 a.m., with the policeman in the bedside chair, nicely shaven, pencil and notebook at the ready.
By midday, he was sitting back with a cup of tea and expressing his gratitude for an abortive 2 hours that had yielded precisely nothing. At least nothing in the official sense, although he had appreciated being sadly smiled at now and then by one so young and beautiful.
"Well, I'll be off now, Miss Leopold, and if anything does happen to pop into your mind, just send me a message and I'll be up here in 2 flicks of a duck's tail."
He rose to go, replaced the rubber band around the blank pages of his notebook with a reluctance not entirely official, mounted his tall grey horse, and trotted slowly down the drive towards his 1 o'clock dinner in low spirits that even his favourite plum pie did nothing to dispel. On the following Saturday afternoon, the Macedon Grapevine reported the arrival of another visitor at the lodge, a lady, pretty as a picture in lilac silk, in a buggy and pair driven by a foreign gentleman with a black moustache who had asked the way to Lakeview at Manasseh's store. Everyone on the Mount knew that Mrs. Cutler was caring for the heroine of the college mystery, rescued on Hanging Rock by Colonel Fitzhubert's handsome young nephew from England. The latest turn of events was juicy enough to set the village of Upper Macedon gossiping and guessing all over again. It was rumoured that the nephew had broken all his front teeth, scaling a 60-foot precipice, that he was madly in love with the girl, that the lovely little heiress had sent to Melbourne for 2 dozen chiffon nightdresses and wore 3 strings of pearls in bed at the lodge. In point of fact, the heiress's formidable pile of Morocco leather luggage stood as yet unopened in Mrs. Cutler's vestibule. And who but La Petite, thought Mademoiselle fondly, could look so beautiful, so chic, wrapped in a faded Japanese kimono. The Venetian blinds were drawn against the green garden light that rippled on the white shed walls of the bare little room and on the immense double bed with its patchwork quilt, seemingly afloat in a sea cave. The soft summer air caressed and healed like water. They wept a little, embraced long and tenderly, abandoning themselves after the first impassioned greetings to the silent luxury of sorrow shared. There was so much to be said, so little that ever could or would be said. The shadow of the rock lay with an almost physical weight upon their hearts. The thing was beyond words, almost beyond emotion. Mademoiselle was the first to return to the tranquil reality of the summer afternoon, drawing up the blinds with a reassuring click of the present peace of the garden beyond. The weeping elm at the window was murmurous with gossiping doves. "Let me look at you, chérie." The wan little face, framed by a fan of ringlets loosely tied by a scarlet ribbon, was almost as white as Mrs. Cutler's calico pillows. "Too pale, but so pretty. Do you remember how I scolded you for rubbing geranium petals on your lips? But see, I have the wonderful news for you." On Diane's outstretched hand, an antique French ring flashed a million rainbows on the patchwork quilt, and Irma's dimple came out like a star. "Darling Mademoiselle, I'm so glad! Your Louis is a lovely man." "Tiens, you have guessed it already, my secret." "I didn't guess. Dear Diane, I knew. Miranda used to say I guessed with my head and knew with my heart."
"Ah, Miranda," the governess sighed. "Only 18 and such wisdom."
They fell silent again as Miranda floated towards them over the lawn with shining hair. Mrs. Cutler, who had taken an immediate fancy to the elegant French lady, now appeared with a tray of strawberries and cream.
"Dear Mrs. Cutler, what would I have done without her? And the Fitzhuberts, how kind everyone is!"
"And the handsome nephew?" Mademoiselle wanted to know. "Is he also kind? Oh, what a profile in the newspapers!"
Irma had nothing to say of the nephew, reported still too weak to leave his room.
"You forget, Diane, I only saw Michael Fitzhubert once, in the distance, on the day of the picnic."
"A woman can see everything necessary in the wink of an eye," Mademoiselle observed.
"Tiens, when I first see the back of my Louis's head, I say to myself, 'Diane, that man is yours.'"
As it happened, Mike was at this moment reclining on the lawn in a deck chair with his aunt's carriage rug wrapped about his long legs. Beyond the sloping lawn, the lake, studded with open lily cups, lay like burnished pewter, reflecting the afternoon light. From it came the lusty cries and grunts of Albert and Mr. Cutler, guiding a punt through the lily pads in search of tangling water weeds. In the light blue sky that he would always associate with his Macedon summer, little woolly white clouds were sailing across the dark spikes of the pine plantation on the mountain's crest. For the first time since his illness, he was conscious of a faint stirring of pleasure in his surroundings.
"Ah, oh, there you are, Michael. In the fresh air at last."
Mrs. Fitzhubert, weighed down with parasol, cushions, and needlework, had appeared on the veranda.
"Tomorrow you shall have a visitor to brighten you up.
You remember Miss Angela Sprack from Government Cottage?"
The nephew, however, showed no enthusiasm at the prospect of a tête-à-tête with the Sprack girl, of whom he remembered nothing but the ninepin legs and a pink and white face that had reminded him of a simpering Reynolds portrait in the dining room at Haddingham Hall.
"I can't imagine why you're so critical of poor Angela."
"I don't mean to be critical. It's entirely my fault that I find Miss Sprack, how can I express it, too English."
"What's all this poppycock about being too English?"
asked the Colonel, emerging from the shrubbery with the spaniels.
"How the deuce can a person be too English?"
Mike, however, felt unequal to carrying on the argument on an international level. The visit from Government Cottage was got through somehow on the following afternoon. The Sprack girl was just what Mike had expected, the kind he was implored by his mother to make a point of waltzing with at a country ball.
"Damn it, Angie," the Major complained as they drove down the avenue in the vice-regal dog-cart. "You're a regular nincompoop. Don't you realise that young man is one of the best matches in the whole of England? Fine old family. Title any day. Plenty of cash."
"I can't help it if he's not interested in talking to me," sniffed the wretched girl. "You could see for yourself how it was this afternoon. I'm positive he dislikes me, and that's the end of it."
"You cast-iron goose! Have you no crumb of social sense? I've no doubt the little beauty up at the Lakeview Lodge will have a try for the Honourable Michael, heiress or no."
As soon as Michael had dutifully assisted those ghastly legs to clamber up into the dog-cart, he had decided to take a stroll down to the lake before dinner. The Spracks, like all boring guests, had stayed far too long,
and already the sky was flecked with sunset clouds, the lake calm and lovely in the fading light. He had just turned his back on the retreating dog cart and was walking rather unsteadily across the lawn when his ear caught the splash of water coming from the direction of the lake, where a girl in a white dress was standing beside a giant clamshell that served as a bird's bath under an oak. The face was